Welcome back to Behind the Scams. This story is a perfect example of how sophisticated scams have become.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, we're just not dealing with that old stereotype anymore. You know, the lone wolf in a basement sending out poorly spelled emails.
Right, like the classic Nigerian prince stuff.
Exactly. Now it's highly organized, industrialized fraud. And if you aren't paying attention to the specific data trails they leave, you are just incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah, which is exactly why we're so glad you're joining us for this deep dive today. And just as a quick piece of context for you listening, our show is proudly part of the SOS Media Network. We advocate for scam prevention day in and day out, and we were overseen by Nick Henley.
Right, Nick is great.
Yeah, I was actually chatting with Nick about today's case recently, and I mean, between his 25 years in law enforcement specializing in financial crimes and his current work as a licensed private investigator, he has seen the entire evolution of these syndicates firsthand.
Oh, absolutely. And plus, Nick and his wife frequently tag team these investigations, which is so cool because it brings this incredible boots on the ground reality to the high level threat intelligence that we analyze here.
Right. It prevents us from just looking at the theory.
Yeah, it grounds it. We get to see how these scams operate in the real world, like against real people.
And the real world impact we are tracking today is just staggering. We are basically tracing the anatomy of what is emerging as the massive scholarship sabotage and financial aid fraud crisis of 2026.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It really is. So we've got a formidable stack of intelligence to guide us today. We're pulling from threat reports from CloudSec and Before AI, plus academic studies like the CVF Open Access study on deepfakes and the STAM research on synthetic trust, and raw data from Goldie Beacom College and Biometric Update.
That's a lot of data.
It is. But instead of getting bogged down in all the white papers, let's just look at the underlying logic of the scam itself. Because, I mean, every massive financial fraud has to start with a foundation, right? You can't steal a scholarship if you don't have a student.
Right, exactly. That is the primary hurdle for the syndicate. They need to acquire an identity. You know, you need a real person to apply as.
Sure.
Now, I think a lot of people might assume this involves some, I don't know, complex targeted breach of a university's mainframe to alter records.
Like a movie hacker scene.
Yeah, exactly. Like typing furiously on a keyboard. But the reality is far more mundane, and frankly, it's a lot cheaper. They just go shopping on the dark web.
Wow.
Yeah, they buy what the underground ecosystem calls full cells, which is basically a comprehensive, pristine identity profile containing everything, like from a social security number and date of birth to current addresses and credit histories.
Okay, wait, I want to stop right there and push back on the economics of this a bit. Because I know identities are traded constantly, but what's the actual street value of a comprehensive human identity in 2026?
You'd be surprised.
Well, my assumption is that a flawless profile that can bypass a federal loan check has to carry a pretty premium price tag, right?
You would think so, yeah. But the latest CloudSec threat intelligence paints a very different picture. The going rate for a high-quality, fully fleshed-out identity profile is currently hovering right between $50 and $120.
$50? I mean, I'm sorry, but that sounds way too low for a pristine identity.
I know, it sounds crazy.
Are we sure these aren't just recycled credentials that have already been flagged by financial institutions?
That was exactly what I thought when I first saw the numbers. But the supply is just that massive. I mean, we've had so many data breaches over the past decade that the market is entirely saturated.
Oh, so it's really just a supply and demand issue.
Completely. And the platforms selling these profiles, these specialized CC or credit card shops like Russian Market, Brian's Club, or the newer STYX Market, they operate on a high volume, low margin business model.
It's fascinating because it completely shatters the illusion that cybercrime requires deep technical expertise. Like, I was looking through the screenshots of these marketplaces from the reports, and they are literally indistinguishable from legitimate e-commerce sites.
They really are. They have user-friendly interfaces. They have robust search filters where you can hunt for a victim in a specific zip code or with a specific credit score bracket.
That is terrifying.
Yeah, and they use secure PGP encrypted logins. They even use cryptocurrency, primarily Monero, to ensure the payments are completely untraceable.
Yeah, and I noticed they also incorporate AI checkers built directly into the platform. Like if I'm a buyer, I can click a button and the site's AI will automatically run a microscopic fraction of a cent test charge to verify the identity or the card is still live before I commit my $50. It is literally like an automated vending machine for fraud.
That is a perfect analogy. And they even offer customer service and refund guarantees if the profile turns out to be a dud.
Wow, customer service for criminals.
Right. So The barrier to entry for the scammer is effectively zero at this point. I mean, anyone with a Tor browser and a few bucks in crypto can walk away with a synthetic identity.
Okay, so the criminal has their $50 identity, but I'm kind of stuck on the logistics of what happens next. Like, setting up a fake profile is one thing, but if I'm the scammer, I can't exactly walk onto a college campus, sit in a lecture hall, and pretend to be this person.
Right, obviously not.
So how do they actually operationalize a stolen identity into an educational grant payout?
So that's the transition into what the higher education sector is now calling the ghost student crisis.
Yeah.
And the methodology is incredibly systematic.
Okay, walk me through it.
First, the criminal uses the stolen credentials to create or hijack an account on a secure portal like studentaid.gov. And the very first action they take, and this is just a brilliant piece of operational security, is changing the communication preferences.
Oh, they swap out the email.
Exactly. They swap out the victim's email and phone number for their own burner accounts.
So the actual victim whose identity is being used is entirely insulated from what's happening. Like, they never get a confirmation email saying a new application was filed.
Not a single notification.
Yeah.
They are completely in the dark.
Whoa.
Yeah, so once that silent takeover is complete, the scammer submits a falsified FS, you know, the federal financial aid application, in the victim's name. So now they are officially in the system.
Okay, but to my point about attending class, how do they get away with that?
Well, they don't attend. They specifically target schools that offer asynchronous online classes.
Oh, of course. Asynchronous means no live Zoom lectures, no physical attendance.
Right.
You just log into a portal, read the syllabus, and submit assignments on your own schedule.
Precisely. And this is where the scammers leverage basic AI tools. I mean, they aren't using large language models to write brilliant A-plus term papers.
They don't need to.
Exactly. They prompt the AI to act like a struggling average freshman. They'll have it generate generic introductory discussion board posts with a couple of intentional typos.
Just to look human.
Yeah, they just need to create enough digital footprints to look like an active student for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the semester.
Just long enough for the financial disbursement mechanics to kick in. Let's trace the money here, actually, because that's the whole point of this.
Yeah, sell the money.
Right, so the federal aid covers the tuition, which the school automatically absorbs, but the excess aid, the money meant for textbooks, housing, living expenses.
That excess is dispersed directly to the student.
Or in this case, the scammer.
Right. And we're often talking about several thousand dollars per enrollment. So the funds get wired to a fraudulent bank account that the scammer opened using that same $50 identity. The money is quickly moved into a crypto mixer, and the ghost student simply stops logging into the class and vanishes.
It is an industrialized looting of the education system. And we aren't talking about isolated incidents here. The scale is devastating. Like, looking at the raw data from 2024, California community colleges alone tracked 1.2 million fraudulent applications.
It's wild.
And that resulted in at least 223,000 suspected fake enrollments and an $11 million unrecoverable loss. Oh, and the College of Southern Nevada wrote off $7.4 million in a single semester.
It's a massive bleed on public resources.
Yeah.
But there's a missing link here that we really need to address.
What's that?
Well, colleges aren't completely blind, right? They have admissions counselors,
yeah.
Financial aid officers. If 200,000 suspicious applications flood in, someone is going to pick up a phone to verify the student.
Right.
A bot can generate a convincing discussion board post, but it can't hold a live conversation with an admissions officer.
Okay, wait, how are these fake students bypassing human verification and phone calls from admissions offices? Because that seems like the ultimate roadblock.
Which brings us to the technological weaponization of the scam. If a college gets suspicious and tries to call the applicant, the scammers have an answer for that too. Deepfake audio.
Oh man, of course.
Yeah, voice cloning has evolved from a novelty into a primary tool for fraud. If an admissions office calls to verify a strange application, they are met with a perfectly natural sounding synthetic voice that calmly answers all the security questions.
That is so creepy.
It gets worse. Sometimes the syndicates flip the script. They use deepfakes to impersonate college officials, like cloning the voice of a director of financial aid. And they call real students demanding an urgent processing fee payment over the phone.
But I assume we have detection software to catch this, don't we? I mean, the tech industry releases new AI audio benchmarks constantly. Shouldn't institutional security filters flag a synthetic voice instantly?
In theory, yes. But the recent CVF open access studies on computer vision and pattern recognition highlight a catastrophic failure in our current detection methods.
Really? How so?
Well, The standard detection algorithms, like the widely used ASV21 benchmark, they rely on sterile laboratory-controlled data.
Okay.
So they are trained to identify the clean, predictable digital artifacts that voice synthesis programs leave behind in perfect conditions.
But scammers aren't operating in a soundproof laboratory.
Far from it. They know exactly how the detection software works, so they intentionally obfuscate the synthetic nature of the audio. They use a technique researchers are calling digital insects.
Digital insects. I love that term. What exactly does a digital insect do to the audio file?
It's essentially acoustic camouflage. A digital insect might be a faint engineered crackle in the audio, a subtle hiss, or a simulation of bad cellular reception.
Oh, so just adding noise.
Exactly. They might layer in quiet background music or street noise and make tiny micro edits to the pacing. So when the detection software analyzes the audio, it doesn't see the clean mathematical pattern of a deep fake.
It just sees a messy, degraded waveform.
Right. The algorithm gets confused by the noise and categorizes it as a low-quality real phone call.
So the software just lets it pass. And if the machine fails, what chance does a human have? Like, can a trained admissions counselor hear the difference?
The human element is actually the most alarming part of the research. When tested against these obfuscated deepfakes, human detection is hovering right around 55.5%.
55.5%?
Yeah.
That is literally a coin toss. You have a marginally better chance than random luck of figuring out if you're talking to a human being or an algorithm.
It's scary.
So if we synthesize all of this, the technology has officially outpaced both our ears and our software. It turns the entire verification process into a high-stakes guessing game where the scammers own the house.
And this methodology isn't restricted to local community colleges either. The exact same tactics are being deployed against the highest levels of the federal government, which kind of shifts us from targeting students to targeting institutions.
Yeah, this is where we need to look at the B4 AI intelligence report regarding the U.S. Department of Education's G5 grant portal. Because, you know, the G5 is essentially the central nervous system for managing massive federal education funding.
It's an absolute gold mine for scammers. They are actively cloning the G5.gov website to harvest administrative credentials. But, you know, it's the timing of the attack that's so brilliant.
Right, the April pressure cooker.
Yes, exactly. They execute these campaigns during what the sector calls the April pressure cooker, which is the absolute peak of the high-stress financial aid season.
Right, everyone is working overtime, deadlines are looming, and the scammers deliberately layer on additional panic to break down people's defenses. Like, the intelligence report noted how scammers weaponized a recent Trump administration announcement regarding 1,400 Department of Education layoffs.
Yeah, that was a huge factor.
They use that real-world news to create a baseline of severe anxiety. I mean, when people are worried that their department is severely understaffed or that a multi-million-dollar grant will be delayed because of layoffs, they are primed to rush through their workflows.
Absolutely. That psychological manipulation is the true core of the attack. Actually, in our discussions with Nick about this case, he mentioned a fantastic point about this.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
He said that after decades of investigating financial crimes, the one constant is that scammers don't just hack systems, they hack the victim's state of mind. He pointed out very specific digital red flags that highly educated professionals completely ignore when they are put under pressure.
Right, Nick pointed to the B4 AI evidence showing that the clone G5 sites are visually flawless, but structurally they're completely broken. For instance, an administrator will log in completely ignoring the fact that the URL is submitting their secure data to a generic analytics.php page instead of a secure federal server.
Yeah, and Nick also highlighted the infinite loop tactic they use.
The updates.php thing.
Exactly. A victim types in their password, hits enter, and the page just spins and redirects them back to a simulated login screen using an updates.php script.
Right, and the victim naturally assumes the government servers are just bogged down from the April rush, so they type their password in again. Meanwhile, the fake site is quietly lugging their credentials.
Yeah. And Nick also mentioned how they build false authority to force compliance. Scammers will embed incredibly dense, fake legal citations into their phishing emails.
Oh, right, the subsection 4C thing.
Yes. They'll reference severe penalties under a completely made-up subsection 4C of the federal code if the administrator doesn't log in immediately to verify a grant. Under normal, calm circumstances, an administrator would spot check a random legal code. But when they're stressed and moving fast, they just comply.
Which serves as the perfect bridge into the cognitive science behind all this. Because this brings us to the STAM research, synthetic trust attacks. STAM maps out how syndicates manufacture credibility across a multi-stage operation.
Really fascinating stuff.
And the most vital contribution from that research is their breakdown of stage six, which they call decision compression.
Decision compression, yes. Let's really unpack the mechanics of that for the listener, because it feels like the Rosetta Stone for understanding why smart people fall for these scams.
Yeah, I agree.
So stage six is the precise moment the trap snaps shut. It's when the scammer artificially bundles urgency, authority, and fear to compress a victim's verification window down to near zero.
Okay, give me an example.
Imagine you receive an urgent email from what looks like the Department of Education. It's backed up by the very real news of impending layoffs, and it tells you that a critical grant for your university will be permanently canceled in 30 minutes if you don't click the link to verify your status.
So your verification window, you know, the time you would normally take to walk down the hall, grab a cup of coffee, and ask a colleague, hey, does this email look right to you? That window is entirely vaporized.
Evaporated. The scammer forces you into a binary choice. You either act immediately or be responsible for losing millions of dollars in funding.
I'm really glad we are digging into this, actually, because I want to challenge a narrative that I see constantly. Whenever one of these massive fraud stories breaks, the public immediately defaults to victim blaming.
All the time.
The comments are always, how could they be so gullible? Why didn't they check the URL? I would never fall for that. But this STAM research proves that it has absolutely nothing to do with being gullible.
It doesn't. It's fundamentally an issue of neurobiology. Decision compression physically hijacks the brain's deliberative processing. It's based on dual process theory in cognitive science. We have a slow, logical, critical thinking brain, and we have a fast, automatic, survival-oriented brain.
So under extreme time pressure and emotional load, our prefrontal cortex, the logical part, essentially shuts down, and we default to automatic compliance. We aren't making a reasoned choice, we are reacting to an artificially engineered survival scenario.
Exactly. The scammers manufacture a localized reality where pausing to verify feels like a catastrophic risk. They make skepticism feel dangerous.
That is a terrifying level of psychological control.
It really is.
But we can't leave the listener feeling like resistance is futile here. If our own neurobiology is being weaponized against us, how do we fight back? What is the practical antidote to decision compression?
Well, the antidote is surprisingly straightforward, and it comes straight out of the STAM protocols. It's a practice called calm, check, confirm.
Calm, check, confirm. Walk us through how that actually works in practice.
The entire defense hinges on instituting a mandatory, non-negotiable, 5-minute cognitive pause.
Okay.
Before you authorize any financial transfer, before you click an urgent federal grant link, or before you pay a surprise scholarship redemption fee over the phone, you force yourself to physically stop for 5 minutes.
That's the whole intervention. Just step away from the keyboard for 5 minutes.
That's the intervention, because 5 minutes is all the time your brain needs for that emotional spike to recede, allowing your prefrontal cortex, your logical critical thinking center, to reboot.
That makes so much sense.
Yeah, you break physical contact with the screen or the phone. Once you are calm, you move to the check phase.
And I imagine checking means doing it out of band. Like, you don't reply to the suspicious email.
Never. You go to your browser and type in the official website yourself. Or you look up the official phone number for the financial aid office independently and make a fresh call. You break the scammer's communication channel.
Got it.
Then, and only then, if everything is legitimate, do you confirm the action.
It's elegantly simple. By forcing that pause, you completely short-circuit their psychological attack. You reclaim your verification window, and by denying them the decision compression, you deny them the scam.
Absolutely. You take away their single greatest weapon, which is your own panic.
That is incredibly empowering and a protocol everyone listening can implement today. But before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over on your own.
Oh, what is it?
Well, we've spent a lot of time today talking about the vulnerabilities of legacy systems, but look at where we're heading. Biometric verification, you know, voice prints, facial recognition, liveness checks, is rapidly becoming the standard way we prove our identities to banks and institutions.
Right. Future is biometrics.
Exactly. But consider this. As biometric security becomes the absolute norm, how long until the syndicates stop bothering to mimic voices on random calls and instead start intercepting the actual biometric verification calls with cloned voices of the very people you are trying to verify with?
Oh, wow.
If the entire security apparatus relies on a voice, and a voice can be perfectly faked and injected in real time, who or what are you actually trusting?
That is a chilling thought. It really is the defining cybersecurity question of the next decade. Because as synthetic trust attacks evolve, our basic definition of proof is just going to have to change.
As always, thanks for tuning in. Stay informed, stay alert, and we'll see you next time on Behind the Scams.